Well, I don't know if there's two other more negatively stereotyped people in culture than used car salesmen and lawyers. Do we have any used car salesmen or lawyers this morning, by the way? Okay, good, I'm safe. I have a lawyer in my family, so I have to be careful how much I say about lawyers. There are some good ones, there are some bad ones, there are some good used car salesmen, there are some bad used car salesmen. But I think most of us have probably been in a situation where going to the used car lot or car lot, we know, we've driven by it before, we've seen the car on the lot, we know which one we're going to look at. But have you ever done the salesman avoidance tactics? You know? I'm going to park in a discreet location off-site. I'm going to walk to the parking lot. I'm going to walk through the aisles of cars and avoid the front desk so that I can get to this car and get out before the salesman sees me, right? Anybody ever done this before? Is it just me? Okay, well, I guess I'm alone. Anyway, if you don't like dealing with salesmen, if you don't want to get caught into an hour-long conversation about this car or that car, or get shuffled around from the around the lot to different options and vehicles, if you're just interested in what you want to see, you've probably done that. And nonetheless, the used car salesmen are negatively stereotyped, as are lawyers. There's tons of lawyer jokes out there. You know any lawyer jokes? You're laughing. Okay, you got a couple? I've got a couple. They're clean, so I thought I'd just share a couple lawyer jokes with you this morning if I could. I'm not a very funny person, so when I get a good joke, I have to share it. What's the difference between a vacuum cleaner and a lawyer riding a motorcycle? The vacuum cleaner has the dirt bag on the inside. I know, that's rough. They're better from here, okay? That was the worst of them. Again, that's why I asked, was there any lawyers? And you said no, so... A man went to a lawyer and asked what his fee was. $100 for 3 questions, answered the lawyer. Isn't that a little steep? Said the man. Yes, said the lawyer. Now what's your next question? A rabbi, a Hindu, and a lawyer are in a car that breaks down in the countryside one evening. They walk to a nearby farm, and the farmer tells them it's too late for a tow truck, but he only has 2 beds, and one of them will have to sleep in the barn. The Hindu says, I'm humble, I'll sleep in the barn. But minutes later, he returns, knocks on the door, and says, there's a cow in the barn. It's against my beliefs to sleep in the same building as a cow. So the rabbi says, it's okay, I'll sleep in the barn. But soon he is back knocking on the door as well, saying, there's a pig in the barn, and I can't shelter in a building with a pig. So the lawyer is forced to sleep in the barn. Shortly, there's another knock on the door, and the farmer sighs and answers it again. It's the pig and the cow. It might take you a second there. They're just bad jokes. I don't know. But nonetheless, we have these cultural figures, right? If it's a used car salesman or if it's a lawyer, somebody that just, right or wrong, gets a bad rap in society. People feel a certain way generally about these individuals. And in Jesus' day, there were folks like that too. They had what they called tax collectors. And tax collectors were these kinds of people that if you saw them in the street, you probably had a certain stereotype that just popped in your mind. And it was dishonest. It was rich, takes advantage of other people. It was out for himself. It was all of these things. And Jesus was dealing with tax collectors in this passage, but he does it in a different way, in one that shocks people in his day because of what people thought about these individuals. They were frequently dishonest, and often for good reason. What they would typically do in Jesus' day, tax collectors would skim off the top of what they collected. Now, we don't have anybody in our society that does this like they did back then, collect taxes. But basically, the Roman government hired out people, individuals, that freelance for them in collecting the taxes. So the Roman government would put forward a number, a figure, that these folks had to collect from people based on their income or based on their different places in society or whatever it may be. And they were responsible for these tax collectors for going out and gathering that amount from this individual. But what they would often do is when they would collect the tax, they would tell the person a different number than they were actually supposed to collect. And the person really had no other option except to pay whatever amount it was. And they would often pay that amount. And the tax collector would take whatever it was, the difference between the two numbers, pay himself for his job, and give the rest to the Roman government. And it was often dishonest work that was done. If you remember the story of Zacchaeus in Luke chapter 19, Zacchaeus is this little guy and he climbs up into a tree to see Jesus one day as he's passing by. And Zacchaeus is a tax collector. And after he sees Jesus, Jesus has a conversation with him. Zacchaeus is convicted of his life and what he had done so far, and he offers to pay back everything that he's unfairly collected, because tax collectors often did that. They were friendly to the Romans because of their work with the Roman government. They were considered an enemy by the Jews, who viewed the Roman government as oppressive. And so they weren't favorably looked at. From any angle that you want to view it, they were not very popular people. And Jesus sees Matthew in this story. We're seeing Jesus in Capernaum still, doing ministry in the Galilean region. He walks by this guy named Levi. In our passage, it's Levi. In others in the Gospel, it's Matthew. Both are the same figure, probably. And Matthew is sitting there by the side of the road, doing his job. And tax collectors would also stand by the way and they would collect toll taxes by a busy route. And probably Matthew was along a busy road, as there was one that went through that area in Capernaum. And he sees this guy, he sees this tax collector, and Jesus calls him to follow him. Now, if you've been with us a couple weeks now through this series, you remember Jesus did this to a group of fishermen on a seashore back in Mark chapter 1. And he does the same thing to Matthew here. It's important to remember, as we talked about it back a few weeks ago, that Matthew is one of the rest of the disciples who left a very wealthy, at times, position to follow Jesus. Fishing was a good business in Jesus' day. These were not poor people, necessarily, that chose to leave everything and follow him. And Matthew is no different. Matthew, like the others that left their nets, left their fishing business on the shores and followed Jesus, Matthew leaves everything and follows Jesus. In fact, that's exactly what Matthew, in his account of his own discipling of Jesus, will say about his own experience. I left everything to follow Jesus. And so he gets up, he leaves this stable, this very wealthy position, very successful position, to follow Jesus. Whatever it was, something was he was attracted to in Jesus, he goes then and invites Jesus to his house for dinner. Because the very next scene we see in this passage is Jesus is eating at what we assume to be Matthew's house with all of Matthew's friends. And if you're like anybody else that's not very well liked in society, you tend to hang around people like yourself who are also very unliked in society. And so Matthew has a bunch of friends over for dinner who are also tax collectors. And Jesus goes to eat there with his disciples. And somehow or another, the scribes and the Pharisees, following Jesus yet again, criticize him for something else he's doing. And they criticize the fact that Jesus is eating, as they say, with tax collectors and sinners. It's important to note in Jesus' day that if you ate with someone, you essentially are accepting them into your circle of friendship. And I know we do this today too. I mean, generally speaking, we don't eat with people that we don't know very well. We generally invite people over for dinner, or we invite people to go to a restaurant with us who are our friends and we want to hang out with. But it was even more intense for Jesus' day. If you were seen in public with somebody else or seen eating with them in your home, it was a sign of acceptance, a sign of companionship and friendship. And so the scribes and the Pharisees can't see Jesus in this position. Why are you eating with these people? Clearly, they're ungodly people. Clearly, they have issues in their life. And so they criticize, telling them that you're getting too friendly with these people. And to be fair to the Pharisees, to be fair to the scribes, they're coming at it from an Old Testament perspective. And if you go back to the Old Testament, you'll see very, very quickly how much God wanted the people to separate themselves from any kind of unholiness. In Leviticus, there's all sorts of commands about ritual washing and cleaning so people wouldn't be unholy and unable to participate in worship. religious leaders were supposed to go through these extensive ceremonies to wash and lead the sacrifice and worship for people. And by extension, any kind of contact with unholiness, any unholy people or any unholy thing would have been disqualifying for being able to participate in the religious life of the Jewish people. It's kind of like today, I don't know if we have some nurses here this morning. If you're a nurse or a medical professional, you know exactly what it's like to wash up for a surgery or for a procedure, right? There's a very, very specific way that you are supposed to wash. And if you're a doctor, you gown up and you get everything on. And you basically walk around so that you don't contaminate until you get into the surgery, until you get into the room, the operating room with that individual, so that you don't contaminate anyone. I actually used to have, my mom's a nurse, and I used to have all of the different kind of garb that you would wear for a surgery. Anybody ever seen this before? It's really, really intense. Like it's got, you've got booties for your feet, you've got a little hair net for your hair, you've got a I call it a blast shield. It's like this plastic piece that goes right in front of your eyes. It ties around your over top of your mouth and protects your eyes from any splattering that may occur in, on the operating table. I just saw some of you squirming. But protecting from any and all bodily fluids, right? There's a gown that goes over the front. And even if you're not a medical professional, if you visited anybody in a critical care unit or some sort of sensitive state where they're not allowed to be in contact with people or sickness could very greatly put them at risk for more health concerns. You have to get one of those robes on before you go into the room, and you have to have somebody out of a sanitized pack, you know, pull one of these gowns and put it on you so that you can go in the room and be with that person. And this is kind of the attitude that the religious leaders had with people and with sin and with unholiness in their day. They didn't want to touch it. They were afraid that any contact with people, any contact with individuals or anything like that would put them at risk for being unable to participate in religious ceremony. And God in the Old Testament is always presented in this way, this distant, kind of disconnected, uninvolved, detached being who really wants nothing to do with the unholy people who serve and worship Him. And by the first century, the religious leaders had developed a sanitized lifestyle where they never engaged with anyone unclean. And so when you read the story of the Good Samaritan, Luke chapter 15, and you read Jesus talking about these people who passed by the Samaritan, if you remember the story, there's a man going on a journey. A Jewish man gets mobbed and robbed on the way to go to a city. Left for dead on the side of the road. He's sitting in a pool of blood. And there are several individuals in that story that walk right by him and ignore him. And they're all religious people, because they wanted nothing to do with blood or dirt or anything that would put them unclean. Mark chapter 7, we'll get this in a couple chapters, but Jesus is questioned by the Pharisees about hand washing and all these things. But the fascinating thing about all this, the attitude that these people held, the religious leaders held in their day, was that if you watched and you looked at Jesus and His ministry, He does the exact opposite. Mark chapter 1, we already read this story. Jesus cleanses a leper, and He does it by touching the man. Mark chapter 7, Jesus will heal the woman who has a discharge of blood. She's been unclean for 12 years. In that same chapter, He will go from that miracle to another miracle where He heals and raises Jairus' daughter from the dead. And when He does it, He touches her. He lays His hands on her. Jesus embraces everything the religious leaders would have shunned and gotten far enough away from, and does the exact opposite. And Jesus is showing the people through this model of behavior that God is dealing with sin in a new way, uncleanness in a new way. It's not separation, but closeness. In the beginning of John, John, the Gospel of John, will start this way. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. And he'll go through that beginning and not tell the story of the birth of Jesus like Luke does, but he'll tell the story of God coming near. And he says, verse 14, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Literally, that word that he uses means to pitch a tent. The story of Christmas is the story of God's Son literally coming into the midst of the people he came to save. If I would have thought about this, I would have put it up on the board for you to see it. But if you read and you look at the Old Testament, remember the tabernacle? Remember the temple? If you go through and you read about the construction of that temple and that tabernacle, you'll read all of the barriers that were put into place between God and His people. God dwelled in the Holy of Holies, in the very inner sanctuary of the temple. Nothing was allowed to touch Him. No one was allowed to go in there except for once a year, the high priest. And even then, the high priest would usually have a rope tied around him with a bell on it. As he performed the sacrifice on the Day of Atonement in the Holy of Holies in the presence of God, he was wearing a bell and a belt with a rope on it. And if that bell stopped dinging and that rope stopped moving, they knew the man was dead and they needed to pull him out. Because nobody goes in the presence of God unholy. There were layers of protection between God and the people. You had the court of the Gentiles. You had the court of the woman. Each of those barriers for certain people groups that weren't allowed to go any further into the temple complex. There were always barriers between God and people. And yet in the New Testament, the beauty of the message of Jesus is that He comes to break all of these barriers down. No longer is there distance between the God who created man and man. In John chapter 1, Jesus is coming to pitch a tent, literally to dwell in the midst of His people without barriers. Paul talks about this in Ephesians chapter 2. I'm going to read Ephesians chapter 2 with you real briefly. If you want to turn there, verses 14 through 19 of Ephesians chapter 2. This is talking about Jesus. It says, "For He Himself is our peace, who has made us both one and has broken down in His flesh the dividing wall of hostility by abolishing the law of commandments expressed in ordinances that He might create in Himself one new man in place of the two, so making peace, and might reconcile us both to God in one body through the cross, thereby killing the hostility. And He came and preached peace to you who are far and peace to those who are near. For through Him we both have access in one Spirit to the Father. So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and the members of the household of God." I believe it's the NIV uses, if you're reading from the NIV, verse 16, "killing the dividing wall of hostility." God broke down the barriers to relationship with Him through Christ. And so you're saying, well, this is great, Scott. This is great theology. I mean, you know, this is a pretty detailed view of God's work with man, but what does it mean? How does it translate into my life? What's the point? If God's model of interaction with the world is to get closer, not farther away, as His followers, do you think we should do the same? Now, I'm going to say something to clarify what I am saying. I get that we're not supposed to be like the world. I'm not saying that. That's not what I'm saying this morning. We as Christians are supposed to stand out, to live differently, have a behavior, a pattern that puts us in a different light as God's followers. I'm not talking about our morals, our standards, our beliefs, anything about the way we live our lives. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the way that we live in relationship with unbelievers and the attitudes that we often hold towards them. And to illustrate this, I'll give you an example. And you don't have to answer this, you just think about it in your head. When was the last time you saw somebody walking down the street and they were dressed a certain way and they were acting a certain way, and all of a sudden you stereotyped them right then and there? I can't believe that people live like this. Why do they do that? It's so frustrating. If they would just clean up a little bit, if they just get that stuff off their arm, if they just get a haircut, if they just, and you start thinking about all the problems that you know have to be a part of their life, right? The attitudes that we hold towards people, often unchristian people, say something about the way that we view God and the way that we think we live with God. Christians have long been accused, unfortunately, of holding judgmental attitudes towards outsiders, towards people who aren't believers. And the funny part about it is that every church that I've ever been a part of, from the time I grew up to the time I interned in college at several different places and worked in different churches, every church thinks they're the most loving congregation. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes that's a fair assessment. But sometimes our assessment of ourselves is different than what people outside this church, and I say this church like any church you're in, might think of you, right? There's a book that came out in 2007. I can't believe it's been over 10 years now, called Unchristian. Anybody ever heard of this book, Unchristian? I don't expect, if you don't go in these circles, that you would ever would have heard of it. But it was a book basically discussing people's perception in the world about Christians. And some of it was fair, some of it wasn't so fair. You know, sometimes people's perceptions of us are improper, just like our perceptions of them are improper, right? So we have to take that into account. But there's a lot of good stuff in the book. And basically, it broke it down each chapter as far as a category of people's perceptions about Christians. And each chapter dealt with a different topic. And one of the topics was too judgmental. People's perception of Christians is that they're too judgmental. And so remember what I talked about. Most people think that their congregation, their church, is the most loving church around, right? At least that's often our perception. Well, if perception is at all real, it's probably not accurate. Because this book was surveying various individuals, unbelievers, and found only 20% of unbelievers thought and of Christians and churches as people who loved unconditionally. Meaning, while we have this perception that we are the most loving congregation, that we love everybody, people's perception on the outside is often the exact opposite. Now, I'm sure there's some rationale or some misunderstandings about people's perceptions of Christians. I get that, right? It's not always fair. It's not always accurate. But doesn't it show that at least there's probably an issue here? That the way that people see us is often not the way we see ourselves, and certainly not the way that we would want God to see us as people. We are often critical of the world being the world. And instead of offering a help or a hand, we offer more criticism. It would be one thing if we were critiquing each other. You know, we all have the same standard here. We all follow Christ or proclaim to follow Christ, and we all adhere to the Bible, and we try to hold ourselves to this standard. But the world doesn't share that standard. Most of them don't have any clue what the standard is or have any desire to follow the standard. And so we shouldn't be surprised when the world acts like the world. And I know there's some objections here, right? With Jesus, at least. Well, Jesus was eating with tax collectors and sinners because he was God. I mean, that's, you know, he's God, right? We can't hold ourselves to the same standard as Jesus because he was the Son of God. He was perfect. Christians shouldn't be involved with the world. I get that. You're right. Jesus was the Son of God. And certainly there are situations that we should avoid as people, because we know if we go there, we might do that. Or if we hang out with them, we might become like them. And what they are isn't what we should be as Christians. I get that. There should be some level of separation. Alcoholics shouldn't be at a party where there's drinking, right? It just makes sense. People with food addictions should avoid potlucks. So don't come to the Super Bowl party, sorry. Although I'm excited about it. People with problems gossiping should avoid the hairdresser. Because isn't that what happens? I mean, I don't know. I'm being silly. But you get my point, right? There are certain places that, yes, we should avoid, especially if we have particular issues that we deal with in life. But didn't Jesus rely on his disciples to continue the mission that he started? Didn't, when he leave, he charge them with a message and a commandment? We call it the Great Commission. Go therefore, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe everything that I've commanded you. Well, I got news for you. If you're going to go into the world and teach and be with people, you're going to have to be with the world. It's going to require us reaching out and being in uncomfortable situations often. I'm sure Jesus wasn't very comfortable sitting at the table with tax collectors. I don't know, maybe I'm speaking too humanly of Jesus, but I'm pretty sure that there was some level of discomfort, because I'm sure they didn't act quite the same that he would prefer. I'm sure that they didn't talk the same way that he would prefer them to talk like. It's just natural. But don't you think that to fulfill the Great Commission, it might require us to get closer? To get closer to the very people that God was trying to get close to when he sent Jesus. To get closer to the very same people that we often want to push away, or we don't want to deal with their stuff, or we feel uncomfortable around them. Maybe it would require us to be closer. One of the most helpful passages that I think about clarifying God's intent for our behavior among the world and among ourselves is 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul is dealing with a really serious issue in the church. Actually, one that he ultimately will tell people, get this guy out of your church. He's messing everything up. It was a guy who had had an incestuous relationship with his father's wife. And Paul is dealing with this problem. And he's written to them already about some of these things, and they're misunderstanding him, and he's trying to clarify what he's actually wanting them to do. So I'm going to read here just a passage out of 1 Corinthians chapter 5. I'm going to start in verse 9 and go to 13. And I want you to, knowing the background of this, I want you to think about what we've been talking about as Paul talks about how do we associate with people in the church and out of the church. He says, I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral people, not at all meaning the sexually immoral of this world, or the greedy and swindlers, or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. But I am writing to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother if he is guilty of sexual immorality or greed, or is an idolater, reviler, drunkard, or swindler, not even to eat with such a one. Again, there's the eating thing. For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Is it not those inside the church whom you are to judge? God judges those outside. Purge the evil person from among you. Paul says, I have no business dealing with what God's going to do with people outside. God will take care of that. That's not my job. Our job here is to hold us each accountable to what we understand to be biblical standards of living. But outside the world is the world. And I'm not writing to you, he says, not to associate with anybody outside, because then you would have to go out of the world. You have to live in the world. Paul never meant for the Corinthians to hold themselves up in this little building against everyone else, to cut themselves off from every person that they would see outside, the very people that God was trying to impact. Jesus says, because those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I want to ask you a question, and maybe help you think a little bit this year about your life and about those you interact with. Who is an unwell person in your life? And by unwell, I mean they need Jesus. Seriously, they need Jesus. God needs to get a hold of them. Maybe their family patterns are dysfunctional. Maybe their way of talking or acting is dangerous and reckless. Maybe they're making a mess of their personal life or their job. It's coming in between them and their ability to function. Is there an unwell person in your life? Or maybe it's not so drastic. Maybe it's just something someone's dealing with. Maybe they're dealing with depression, deep, deep, dark depression. Maybe they're losing hope. Maybe there's something that's happened to them, a tragedy that they're really struggling with. Who's an unwell person in your life? Who needs your touch, your friendship, your compassion? You to draw near to them because they so desperately need help. And they don't need your help. They need God's. They don't need any, you know, feel-good stuff. They need the hope, the peace that passes all understanding. How can we better impact this community? By drawing closer to the hurting, the lost, and those in need of a Savior. And what would change in your life and in their lives if you made that step? If instead of listening to that uncomfortable feeling that you often get when you're around them and stepping further away from them, that you actually step further towards them. And instead of avoiding that conversation, you actually ask them some questions and engage with them. And instead of avoiding the break room because you know what it's like with the people that are there, you actually came in and sat down. I want to show you a video as we close of a man who is a preacher at a church, well-known church. He wanted to do a little testing of his congregation. I want you to watch this video as we close.
The closer the person is to us, and the less common the struggle, the easier it is to love. God forbid I find out my wife has 3 months to live. I quit my job, I quit everything, right? What if it's just an acquaintance of yours? And what if the problem's recurring? The more common and further from us, how common is homelessness? And how frequently is the homeless person someone dear to us personally? Never. I took a few moments a couple of weeks ago and camped outside of a couple of our campuses, and I wanted to see how we were doing, you know, when it's hardest to love. Do you know that your Father in heaven is giving the same graces to the person that's hardest for you to love? He's giving it. He's giving. He doesn't play favors. He's giving the grace to everyone. And if we're going to love like our Father in heaven loves, we don't get to play favorites. And by favorites, I mean so often we love the people where there's some benefit in it for us, right? Okay, fine. I'll call my brother when I get home. I haven't talked to him for 2 years, but I'll call him. Really, will you? Will you? Because that's going to work out pretty good for you, right? Now everything's going to be good with your brother. Your mom will get off your back, and your sister's not going to think you're a jerk anymore. And I mean, this is, but see, that's not what I'm talking about. Yes, do that. But not just that. Where it's not your favorite, where there's nothing in it for you, where it's not an upgrade to your portfolio of awesomeness. So how did our church do in the video? I'm going to tell you now. Awesome. I was crying inside that beard. I cannot believe the people in this church. The number of people that prayed with me and brought me food. Just watch and see.
Are you bringing us something to eat this morning? Here's a coffee. A coffee to keep it warm. Let's just pray for you real quick. Dear my Father, so thankful, Lord, that you brought this man to your church on your day, Lord. We are so blessed that he is here. Lord, we pray, Lord, into this man and just bless him and love him. Bless you.
God, I just pray that you would just meet this man, and Father, that if he would be your will, that you would just have him come into our church, but you would just know the love of Christ. I don't want you to be out here without knowing him, okay?
You're welcome to come inside. We'd love to have you.
You can come in. Can you want?
That's all right.
How you doing tonight? Doing okay? Would you like to come in and have church with us? And sit with us for church?
Excuse me. Is there like someone praying for you, or is it?
Hey, but I got some water for you. And something more valuable. The Word of God here. And God bless you.
Is there anything I can be praying for you, sir?
Can I pray for you?
Thank you, Father, for this morning. Thank you for this beautiful day. And thank you for my friend here. I just pray that you be with him today. Give him everything he needs. Provide for him. God, you are our provider. You love us. You care for us. And you love this man right here.
Who's the unwell person in your life this year? Who needs a little bit of hope? And how can you make one step towards them instead of away from them? We're going to sing a song here. Kevin's going to get up and lead us an invitation song. If you need to respond to the message, we'd love to take whatever response you need to give. And if you need some healing in your life or prayers or any way we can help, please let us know as we come and stand and sing.